Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. John Abramczyk appearing today on behalf of the appellants. May it please the court. This is an appeal about an indemnification case that we say the Superior Court prematurely dismissed on summary judgment. It's a case where the former stockholders of a company called Bridge Medical brought a lawsuit against AmerisourceBergen to collect more than $5 million in attorney's fees due to them under an indemnity obligation in the merger agreement which governed AmerisourceBergen's purchase of Bridge Medical. The Superior Court entered summary judgment on two grounds, both of which we say were erroneous. First, res judicata, and second, the statute of limitation, under the statute of limitations. Neither of those doctrines should apply in this circumstance because this was an indemnification case that did not accrue until the court below made a determination of liability. That's the way indemnification works. Until there is a determination of liability, there is no claim. The Superior Court.
I have two preliminary questions. First, did you ask for attorney's fees in the Court of Chancery? And second, if they would have been awarded, how would they have been different from the attorney's fees that are the subject of this appeal?
There was a prayer for relief, a general prayer for relief in the original proceeding, and it was carried through, as the briefs point out, in the pretrial order. Attorney's fees, the attorney's fee claim was never presented, never litigated. There is no dispute, and I think it's important to know, there is no dispute that there never was an indemnification claim in the case. There is law, and we cited in our brief, that a claim for indemnification is not the same as a prayer for relief, and I guess to say it the other way, a prayer for relief is not a claim for purposes of res judicata. To answer the court's second question, how would it be different? We had requested in the prayer for relief, based on the fair and equitable principles that everybody relies on to get out from the ordinary American rule, that if there were bad faith proven at trial, that we would seek fees. How that would knit with the indemnification obligation would depend on exactly how the facts unfolded and whether there ever was a determination of liability. But importantly, to go to both of the court's questions, the prayer for relief is not the same as a claim, and a prayer for relief for attorney's fees is certainly not the same as a claim for indemnification. And that's what makes this analysis different, and that's the distinction that the Superior Court didn't either perceive or accept. We are particularly perplexed by that in this case because there were important concessions made by AmerisourceBergen in addressing these issues. And in particular, as it relates to res judicata, it's clear, of course, that...
Before we leave that, just help me go through this. You go to the Court of Chancery and you say you breached the agreement and you owe us for breaching the agreement. And in addition to that, because we've had to expend money on an attorney to establish the breach, you owe us for the attorney's fees. And that would have been a self-contained, standalone Court of Chancery action. And if the Court of Chancery would have agreed with you, you'd have gotten the damages plus the attorney's fees. Now, since you just got damages in the Court of Chancery, you're coming back to the Superior Court saying, since the Court of Chancery agrees with us that you breached, we're entitled to attorney's fees, and we're calling that claim now indemnification. Is that basically where we are? We're characterizing it as a claim for indemnification.
Not at all, Your Honor. And there's an important distinction embedded in that, and that is that the litigation brought in the first instance for the breach of the contract that included the prayer for attorney's relief would not have been all part of one self-contained litigation had it included a claim for indemnification, because as we point out in our papers, there would be no way to determine whether the indemnity had to be paid until there was first an underlying finding of breach.
So my last interruption is basically the measure of damages for attorney's fees would have been the same either way. Is that right?
No. Respectfully, Your Honor, it may not have been. We don't know because there could be scenarios, for example, in which attorney's fees would have been awarded because of their bad faith behavior on one claim, for example. And it wouldn't have been all of our attorney's fees, or the court ruled in our favor on liability. And essentially what it did here is, you remember on the facts of the underlying proceeding, we got 6 cents in damages on one claim and $21 million on the other. So there are a number of different scenarios where it is not necessarily the case that the claim for attorney's fees based on equitable fee-shifting principles would have taken us anywhere near the full extent of the indemnification that's due once the court says that they're liable for the breach and once they refuse to pay, which goes to the second point of your question, which is, wouldn't this have been a self-contained proceeding? And I think it's important to focus on this fact because the principles of res judicata really, in part, go to this claim splitting or efficiency issue. But here, and in all the cases that both the briefs on both sides examine, when carefully examined, you see that there always has to be this second proceeding when you're trying to collect on an indemnity claim because you just don't know until the gavel comes down in the trial court whether or not you're going to be entitled to that indemnification. And we say that's the appears to be the important feature of the indemnification claim that the Superior Court didn't appear to fully appreciate, and that is that indemnification claims are just different. And they're importantly different in the context of res judicata in that they require this predicate finding of a breach.
It seems to me that you're asking us to look at this in the light in which I would look at a claim under Section 145. But here we're governed by the contract. And the contract doesn't say anything about any determination by a court that there has been a breach. It talks about any breach. So when one reads 8.2b, doesn't the right and entitlement need to assert indemnification accrue at the time your clients thought there was a breach?
Not at all. If it were, thinking in terms of the sort of analog from the 145 cases, then it would be an advancement provision. Because, and I think when AmerisourceBergen reduces the argument to that very point, it betrays the infirmity of their position as it relates to the res judicata point. Because they have essentially stepped back and said, well, look, how can it possibly be, if the language doesn't say a finding of breach is what they tag us with, and you want to say it requires a finding of breach when you read Section 8.2, we say, of course it does, and that's the only way it can be read, because if not, what are they suggesting, that whenever we on the Bridge Medical side thought there was a breach, they would owe us the indemnity? When we pleaded it, they were going to pay the indemnity? When the court hadn't yet decided they were going to pay the indemnity? But more to the point, it's not just that speculation that drives this analysis. If you look at the record below, it's quite clear that until they stepped before the podium in this case, AmerisourceBergen didn't believe that their obligation to pay us had accrued as soon as we filed the original claims. They certainly didn't believe that. Their briefs below are rife with references to the fact that until there was a final determination made by this court on the underlying liability, there was a real risk of inconsistent adjudications. They themselves didn't take the position that this claim was actually a viable claim until they were found to be in breach.
Is it your view that the indemnification claim could not have been filed with the complaint in Chancery, that it was impossible to litigate both at the same time, or is it your position that you could litigate the indemnification either in either action?
Well, our position is that you could not litigate. And Your Honor's decision in the breakaway solutions point, Morgan Stanley, recognizes this point when it talks about when an indemnification claim vests. And the court may remember that in that particular case, the indemnification claim was dismissed because it hadn't yet ripened. There wasn't the underlying obligation hadn't yet accrued in that particular case. So we would have been subject to a motion to dismiss in that case. And we know from AmerisourceBergen's own conduct after the Chancellor even ruled in this case that they weren't taking the position at that point that they owed us the money under the indemnity before the case ended.
But don't we have to be careful what kind of indemnification claims we're talking about? In other words, if you're held liable, then I have to reimburse you. You can't come after me until we know what your liability is. This is that unique set of claims involving attorney's fees. So they're ongoing and concurrent, aren't they?
They are ongoing and concurring, and importantly, in the Celotex case, and again in the cases I think that Your Honor cites in the Morgan Stanley opinion, the breakaway solution opinion, those cases recognize, and particularly in the Celotex case, Vice Chancellor Strine goes through that and recognizes that an indemnification claim like this is not fully, does not accrue until it's fully matured. In other words, there's a sum certain. So you're at the end of the litigation, you know how much the whole amount of attorney's fees are. And in that sense, that particular principle translates directly from the 145 cases back into any contractual indemnity obligation, we say, because that's what the law says. That's the nature of indemnity.
Well, I understand your characterization of indemnification, but help me with your answer to Vice Chancellor Noble's question about whether you could have pursued attorney's fees in the Court of Chancery. As I understand his question, couldn't you have simply said in the Court of Chancery, there's been a breach and we're entitled to damages, and as a result of the breach, if you agree with us, we're entitled to attorney's fees?
Well, no, for a couple reasons, Your Honor, because the indemnity provision here allows us to recover all of our attorney's fees all the way through, including any appeal. And by the very nature of the fact that it's indemnification for all attorney's fees, we couldn't have found the sum certain until the appeal was over. Indeed, we say under the contract even the attorney's fees being incurred on this very appeal still. So there is no purpose under either the res judicata analysis or any other analysis, claim splitting, that would say you should have brought it in the original pleading because you could do this all of one piece. What they come in and they want to say is, aha, you're claim splitting because you really could have done it all in one piece. And we say, no, we couldn't have. There is no legal reason why we can't do precisely what we did here, which is view the indemnity as separate because it hadn't fully accrued until final determination of the liability, which was the necessary predicate for the indemnity claim, establishing the underlying breach. And so we would respectfully say, no, this is not a claim that should or could have been brought in the original proceeding. And as the point I was making with Vice Chancellor Noble was that in the breakaway solutions, the court actually recognized that, and in a somewhat different context, albeit, that an indemnification claim that has not yet matured was dismissible. And so had we brought it in the original action, I'm quite certain that Amerisource Bergen would have thought to come in and say we should dismiss at least that part, or at least for now, because it's not yet right.
Let me suggest from a different area of the law that the cleanest kind of indemnification contract is one that an insurer provides for an insured, and the insurer is not obligated to indemnify until there's been some judgment against the insured. And the insurer is not a party to the litigation, so it's obvious how that's going to work.
Correct.
It's going to be after judgment has been rendered against the insured. In construction arrangements, you run into situations where there are contractors, subcontractors, and owners, and there are relationships between the parties that one indemnifies the other under certain circumstances. There may be the base litigation. The law generally has been you can choose to litigate indemnification in the same suit, or you can wait until there's been a judgment against you, and then the statute doesn't begin to run until that judgment. And you can, in effect, litigate the indemnification claim later. Why is this case different than those typical situations that we see?
Mr. Chief Justice, we would say that it's not different than those typical situations. And not different in any respect that would allow res judicata to permanently bar these Bridge Medical stockholders from enforcing this indemnification obligation. We do have, I suppose, come back a little bit to Justice Holland's question. Well, there is an interesting issue about, well, could we really have brought it in the original action? And I suppose in one sense we would stand here and say, of course, we could have brought it. What would have happened to it is an interesting question, given that people move to dismiss indemnification claims that are not yet ripe. But in that sense, we could have. The point I want to emphatically make this morning to the court is that in the context of res judicata, we were not required to have brought it in the original action for many of the reasons that the Chief Justice just mentioned. We were not required to have brought it. And in that sense, I don't want that the use of the language could have brought it in the original proceeding to be turned back at us and say, well, that means you really had a chance to do it. Our whole point is we didn't have a chance to do it because of the nature of the claim.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I would, Mr. Chief Justice. Thank you.
Uh, Good morning, Justices and Vice Chancellor. I'd like to take a few moments just to make some quick introductions. With me today, Selena Norman and Kathleen McCormick from the Young Conaway firm, and also Debbie Swartz, the Assistant General Counsel of the AmerisourceBergen Corporation.
Welcome to the court.
To address a question that Justice Holland raised right off, he asked what claim was brought below. And I'm just going to read from the plaintiff's pretrial brief, because it shows that the claim for attorney's fees brought below, although not effectively pursued,
you're talking about the Court Chancery, of Chancery.
Court of Chancery.
In the original, this is an appeal from the Superior Court.
Yes, Your Honor. From the Chancery action, from the joint pretrial order, plaintiffs have incurred substantial litigation costs, including attorney's fees and expenses, in prosecuting these claims. If ABC had not breached the merger agreement, plaintiffs would have not incurred these fees and expenses. It is fair and equitable to include as part of plaintiffs' damages the present and future fees and expenses incurred by plaintiffs. That's at the Appendix B-068, Joint Pretrial Order at Paragraph 8. The claim that the Bridge stockholders pursued in the Chancery action for attorney's fees was under the merger agreement for damages for breach of that merger agreement. They did not raise the issue that it was owed for an equitable fee shifting until the Superior Court action. It's very clear what the nature of the claim was below.
Well, is there any significance to the contract term indemnification? I mean, that sounds like a typical prayer when you're looking for equitable relief and a payment of attorney's fees. But what about this contract language and the overlay of the term indemnification, which, again, 100 years ago when I was a litigator, suggests to me intuitively you have two choices in indemnification. You bring it in the original action, or you wait until it ripens and you bring it later, but it's always been a choice, an option to you. Why is this different?
Well, I think the language of the contract answers that question, Chief Justice, and it's Section 8.2B, and it defines, and this is the provision of the merger agreement that the Bridge stockholders are seeking relief. It defines damages, capital D, as damages incurred in connection with, arising out, resulting from, or incident to any breach of any covenant, representation, warranty, or agreement. In other words, it doesn't talk about breach or finding of breach or if you prevail later. It says you can get damages when there is a breach. So the question, since the contract governs the accrual here.
Mr. Bissell, the problem I'm having with that is I understand all that. I see the plain language. I understand your argument about that language. But as I look back to the world of litigation, there still is the argument that, yeah, if there is a breach, and the determination that there is a breach, you have two options. You can litigate at the time you're disputing the breach, that aspect of damages and indemnification as a result of the breach, or you can wait until it's been established that there has been a breach, and you then, because of the choice of the word indemnification, you can then ask to be indemnified because it has in fact been established that there was a breach. But you're not barred from raising it later, and the statute doesn't run against you until the breach has been established by a court of law. Why doesn't that apply here?
Well, I think it doesn't apply here because I think those situations are more typically, like with 145, third-party indemnification situations. And let's think about Scharf, which is the case that Bridge stockholders would like the court to use to change the contract language here. In Scharf, the plaintiff who was seeking the attorney's fees was a defendant or a potential defendant in SEC action. He was waiting around to see if he was going to be sued by the SEC or someone else, and he had incurred some fees in connection with an investigation. But he wasn't in control of his claim. He had to wait and see if he got sued. If he did get sued and did incur fees, then later he could seek third-party indemnification from the corporation he was serving as a director. He really doesn't have much of a choice, and I think that's usually the situation where somebody gets the choice to wait and see if the indemnification arises. This is a two-party indemnification. The claim was controlled by the party now seeking indemnification.
When is it that your client is alleged to have breached the indemnification claim? Because it seems to me that we have a situation where there's a breach of the merger agreement in the sense that proper consideration wasn't paid after the fact. Then we have a second breach, which is there's a failure in terms of 8.2B, there's a failure to indemnify. And that failure to indemnify doesn't happen until Mr. Bramstick's clients are told, no, we're not going to pay. That's 2007.
Well, I think, as the court, one of the members of the panel said, I think it's happening concurrently as the litigation is going on. I mean, they asked for attorney's fees in the complaint. We said, no, we're not going to pay them. I mean, it seems to me the breach, even if it, and I actually believe that.
Let me go back to what I think are litigation practicalities. Young Conaway has filed hundreds of claims for indemnification. I'm willing to bet it has never filed an indemnification claim in a prayer for relief. So what you're saying is that because there's some catch-all attorney's fee claim in the prayer for relief, that sucks in the entire notion of indemnification. Is that really what your argument hangs on?
But no, my argument really hangs on is the Coastal decision, and that it was the bridge stockholders' job to bring all their claims for damages, and these attorney's fees are a species of damages at the time they brought their claim for breach. And that breach accrued, if you will, in February 2004, and because they didn't bring that claim within 3 years, actually they did bring the claim because they didn't pursue that claim in the Court of Chancery during those 3 years. Effectively, it's time barred, and because they did not pursue it in the Chancery action where they could have, it's also raised judicata. There is no reason why they couldn't bring this claim before the Court of Chancery. The Court of Chancery decides attorney's fees entitlement at the end of cases all the time. The Edicts case and the Delaware Shuttle case are examples of that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Delaware Shuttle is different. Delaware Shuttle, is, at least as I recall, and I could be wrong on this, my recollection is there was a fee-shifting provision. If there's litigation and you win, you get paid your legal fees. That's different, isn't it, conceptually, from an indemnification provision?
I actually think a fee-shifting provision would be more favorable to them because then, as in Scharf, there would be a question of when the party actually prevailed and whether there was a new accrual. Here there's no separate event that creates a new accrual. The accrual occurs when there is a breach. The attorney's fees are damages that are part of the original breach. Splitting them into two separate claims just seems directly contrary to Coastal, whose facts are just strikingly similar to this case. I mean, if we take a close look at Coastal, the plaintiff, Ashton, said he had a claim under an agreement for payments. He sought attorney's fees, and then he withdrew that at trial. He was awarded damages. After the judgment was entered, he sent a letter to Coastal saying, oh, and by the way, you do owe me the attorney's fees. Coastal refused to pay. The Superior Court said, oh, no, that's a new claim. It's not barred by res judicata. You can bring that. And this court reversed. This court said that claim for attorney's fees was not a new claim.
Was that, like this, a two-party case?
Yes.
Rather than a third-party indemnification claim?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that's an important distinction that you made earlier.
Yes, it is. And the Certainty case, which we cite to, makes that distinction. And then the Certainty case gets to the I think helps solve some of the riddle of whether there's a new breach when at the end of the litigation someone still hasn't paid. The fact that the final amount of the attorney's fees had not been determined doesn't mean there hasn't been a breach. It doesn't mean that the claim had not accrued. The attorney's fees can continue, the loss can continue to be incurred, but there's no new claim. And that's Certainteed. And Certainteed is the case we rely on chiefly on the statute of limitations argument. Again, that is a two-party indemnification claim under a contract. And the court, you know, clearly said, we're going to look at the contract, we're going to look at what it says about accrual, because we respect contracts, we respect freedom of contract here in Delaware, and that's going to govern.
So where does that leave the indemnification provision in this contract? As I understand your argument, damages is a defined term that would include attorney's fees. Therefore, when you bring an action for breach and you pray for damages, you should ask for all of your damages, including attorney's fees. And so to that extent, if it wasn't done here, your position prevails, and the indemnification is irrelevant to the whole exercise.
That's right. Indemnification, in our view, is just a label that is being put on this claim. It is really a claim for damages. They're suing for damages under the agreement. They needed to bring all their damage claims, whether they're attorney's fees, earn-out payment, what have you, at the same time. And that makes sense in the two-party indemnification context, again, where the plaintiff has control over the claim. The plaintiff can bring all its claims at the same time. And it actually, the rule in COSL and the rule we're urging here prevents the improper splitting of claims. Scharf also tries to prevent the improper splitting of claims, but because it's in the third-party indemnification mode, the party seeking indemnification is not in a position to bring claims until it knows that all claims against it are gone. So that it's both COSL and Scharf are aimed at the same goal. They're both completely consistent. One shows you how you do it in the two-party indemnification situation. The other shows you how you do it in a Section 145 situation.
From a policy perspective, for judicial efficiency or for accommodating the interest of parties, or however you want to characterize it, what would be the better rule in a two-party situation like this, whether the term indemnification raises issues that it might not have necessarily needed to raise had that phrase or that word not appeared, just say you owe me attorney's fees in the event, et cetera, rather than using indemnify, which does generally imply third-party involvement. What's the better rule? Should parties be forced to bring these claims in a two-party contract in the first instance when the breach itself is being resolved, or is it more efficient for them to wait to bring a claim for attorney's fees or any other form of indemnity until they know that they actually have a breach for which indemnification or to which indemnification would apply? What's the better rule?
Your Honor, I think this case shows that the better rule is to force the plaintiff to bring the attorney's fee claim as part of its original claim. Let's think about how this case has gotten to this court. We went through a three-year-long case in the Court of Chancery. What came up here for appeal. That case went to judgment, then appeal. While the case was on appeal, a separate action was started in the Superior Court, and we said it shouldn't be there, but was started in the Superior Court by the plaintiff, where we're going to have a Superior Court judge look at a three-year litigation in the Court of Chancery and decide whether a merger agreement that the Court of Chancery has just spent 3 years with allows attorney's fees and what the reasonable amount of those attorney's fees are. That does not seem like a very good way to proceed. I don't think that every case that has an attorney's fee, a contractual attorney's fee component, requires two cases. In fact, if you take that argument seriously, Mr. Abramczyk, when this case is over, is going to need to go start another case to get his attorney's fees for this case. You're going to have infinite regress. What can be done, and what I think is more typically done, whether it's fee shifting under contract, whether it's fee shifting under the exceptions to the American rule, is that the trial court determines whether the parties are entitled, whether one of the parties is entitled to attorney's fees, and then as part of finalizing the judgment or the taxation of costs, the attorneys put in for their attorney's fees, sort of a fee petition. It's done all the time. I think it works very well. The court that has heard the dispute and that is infinitely familiar with the dispute decides reasonableness and all the other issues.
Going back to the Court of Chancery decision that you started referring to, how was the issue of attorney's fees addressed? It simply wasn't addressed or denied, or what happened to the attorney's fees part of the claim in Chancery?
Okay. The last time the plaintiffs raised the issue of attorney's fees was the portion of the final pretrial brief that I read to Your Honor that said right. They were claiming them under the merger agreement. No proof concerning the attorney's fees was put on at trial. The post-trial decision did not address them. The post-trial decision did not address interest either. But after the post-trial decision, the parties got together to settle an order. Interest was added, but the issue of attorney's fees did not come up. A few days after the judgment was entered, ABC received a letter saying, oh, by the way, we want our attorney's fees under the contract as well.
And that's why you make the analogy to the Coastal decision.
Yes, Your Honor. They're eerily the same. Eerily the same. If I may, just a few notes on ripeness, because I think, again, this addresses maybe some of the practical issues that the panel has raised. Not only did the bridge stockholders actually bring the claim in the Court of Chancery, when they brought the claim in the Superior Court, they brought it before there was a final non-appealable order. They brought the claim for attorney's fees while the Chancery Court action was on appeal to this court. Clearly, when they did that, they did not believe they needed some finality in the Chancery action to be able to bring the claim. This, we suggest, shows that they know they could have brought their claim earlier. It's just another step of conduct they took that shows that they knew they could bring this claim well before they knew what the final result in the Court of Chancery was. A few comments about Scharf. Scharf, as the panel's noted, it arises in the Section 145 context. The language that it interprets in Section 145 and the contract that was at issue, the indemnity contract, which tracks Section 145, is very different from the contract language here. As is typical in a mandatory indemnification situation, the party had to show that he had been successful on the merits or otherwise. That's not what our contract here says. We don't think Section 145, which governs the indemnification of officers and directors, is meant to constrict the freedom of contract between parties to a merger agreement as to how indemnification works. So we respectfully submit that it really doesn't change the result here at all. There's no reason to rewrite the merger agreement to conform it to Section 145 or to Scharf. With that, Your Honor, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before you get started, I invite you to address the policy question that I asked Mr. Bissell, if you have time to do so.
Of course, Chief Justice. As I remember the question, it would be what would be the better rule? Why should there be a requirement, I suppose, that these have to be brought in the first, these claims for indemnification have to be brought in the first proceeding, or can they be brought later upon maturity? In response to the policy concern, Your Honor, we think the path is abundantly clear here because, as I think even Amerisource's authorities show and what they've argued show, there always has to be a second proceeding for indemnification because that's the nature of the beast. Every single one of these cases, even cases that have self-effectuating attorney's fees provision, if you want to step aside and talk about just attorney's fee provisions divorced from the indemnification provision, every single one of these determinations requires further proceedings of the court. And so to say that under a policy reason it makes sense to put down the harsh hammer of the res judicata bar to forever bar a claim based on some efficiency argument is completely illusory. To us, the policy is abundantly clear, and it's really one that the courts have always followed, which is we're not going to bar, the courts will not bar a cause of action that has not previously been litigated under some efficiency theory when, in fact, the claim didn't even ripen until another event had to occur. This is the new facts point that was so clear in the Dover historical case, and we say translate here. So to our view, the policy is already embedded in these cases, and it shows that because another proceeding is necessary, it would be completely inappropriate to bring down the res judicata bar and say you could never come in a second proceeding to litigate something that depends on facts that haven't yet occurred.
And to rule in your favor, it would appear that we'd either have to distinguish or overrule COSL. How do you propose we do that?
Very easily, Your Honor, and I want to get right to that, because to the extent that the other side's relying on COSL, they better hope they're not relying on COSL, because when you read the provision in that case, it's abundantly clear. In COSL, it was a self-effectuating provision that said if the condo association had to employ legal services to go and recover their fees from one of their recalcitrant members, then they were entitled to ask for attorney's fees along with that. It wasn't an indemnification provision at all. And if you listen carefully to the argument and if you look back at their briefs, AmerisourceBergen takes pains here to keep talking about this is just an attorney's fees claim. This is just an attorney's fees claim. You keep hearing attorney's fees claim, and the question well put by the bench today is, well, wait a minute, this is an indemnification claim. And our point is indemnification claims are different. And so this court doesn't have to overrule COSL, but it's easily distinguished because that didn't involve an indemnification provision. It involved a very different kind of provision that didn't depend on a fact that wasn't yet in existence. As soon as the condo association had to go to court or employ a lawyer to get their fees, they were entitled to seek those fees. They didn't have to wait for a determination of court. And that's why it's wrong for AmerisourceBergen to say, look, this was a claim controlled by the party seeking indemnification. I'm sure Chancellor Chandler would be shocked at that, because I think he thinks at least he would have had a role in whether or not there was a finding of liability on the underlying breach. That's what the trial was about. So it is absolutely 180 degrees wrong to say that we, Bridge Medical, controlled our own indemnification claim. We didn't have a right, and they can't seriously be arguing that we had a right to indemnification before the hammer came down on the underlying finding of liability. It didn't exist then. Had we gone to them with that, they would have said probably a number of things. Certainly they would say they wouldn't pay. They said that even after the hammer would come down, they'd probably say it was advancement. And had we brought it initially, they would probably have moved to dismiss it. But we don't have to speculate about that.
What they were saying is that the attorney's fees component is part of the defined term of damages, and therefore you never get to indemnification, and that the damage claim included attorney's fees, and that there should have only been one action for damages.
But you only get there if you completely read out. Remember, damages is in the definition of indemnification. So you only get that if you completely read out the indemnity provision in the contract, which I don't think they're even seriously advocating that position. Just a few quick points because my time's very quickly running out. It is not a difficult issue to talk about the distinction between a prayer for relief for attorney's fees and a claim for indemnification. They admitted it themselves in their own letter when they said, our first amended complaint contained a general demand for fees but did not contain a claim for indemnification under the merger agreement. If you read their letter, which we attached as Exhibit B to our brief, you'll see those important concessions, and they are important here because they're now taking conflicting positions on that. And they clearly prevent summary judgment here, because even if this court were to see that the contract here could be read more than one way, it couldn't be summary judgment. There's no legal reason to bar the Bridge Medical stockholders from enforcing their indemnification right. We respectfully request that this court reverse the determinations of the Superior Court.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.